Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 14. It starts out with, "Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes." So this tells you that he was their governor, or he was the satrap for that province. And he held that position for what? 30 seconds, so that's 20 to 30, so that's 12 years. For 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. So this is a retrospective part of his diary. And he said, look, I was a governor for 12 years now when he wrote this. And we're going to put all these things together because obviously he wrote diaries and letters and it was all put together in the book of Nehemiah. And so he's saying that he did not enrich himself. In fact, he was so prosperous in his administration that they didn't even need to eat or draw from rations from the king's provisions, because the king would have provisions. They'd have storehouses of food. Remember when he first went out there, he had a piece of paper where he can go to these different storehouses and draw stuff, which he did. He drew timber, he drew, you know, money or whatever he needed, food, supplies, laborers, skilled people doing this, doing that. But when he was the ruler or the governor of that province, he was so successful in his capitalistic outlook and how he ran things that they didn't even need to draw from the food allowance at all. And they had a food, like in Texas, we have a rainy day fund. Chicago has no rainy day fund, where you have, basically certain people with certain political persuasions, they bankrupt the place real quick. And so he was very successful. 15, but the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the respect of God. Respect of God. So he basically did not do so because, one, they didn't need to, and two, he's doing his job as under the Lord. We currently have a president that doesn't take a salary, which the news media never mentions. The previous president took every penny of his salary, and yet those boys have a lot of money too. So his salary is like $400,000 a year, and he's not ever taken a salary. And if you're in for 8 years, that's a lot of money. And because of gift tax laws, he has to divert it to one of his agencies. He can't just like give it to the foundation for this, that, and the other, and the state of this or that and the other. So he just circles it over to one of the agencies. So the same thing here. He's not doing it for the money. He's not doing his position for the money. Verse 16, I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. So Nehemiah, again, he puts his money where his mouth is, all the servants he brought with him, because he bought an entourage. They didn't sit back. They also kept their uniforms on. They fought, they bled, they sweated, they built the wall. They did all the things that were necessary to do these things. And you'll see many politicians that will tell this and this and do this and do this. And then, of course, they live a lifestyle that's exactly the opposite. I give you a good illustration of many of these people that want to, they talk about global warming and the carbon and all this stuff, and yet they're the chief offenders. They fly around in jets, they have big houses, and they build their houses on the Gulf Coast, which is supposed to go under the water, and they use up more carbon for their conferences on how to save the world than Jimmy Carter's got liver pills. They want you to ride a bicycle, but they ain't riding no bicycle. Now, Nehemiah, if he said ride a bicycle, he'd be walking. He wouldn't even ride a bicycle. But it's the hypocrisy of it all. And many politicians are very hypocritical. They want you to do it, but they're not going to pay their money to do it. They're not going to give up. In other words, your kids should go to public schools. We don't want to have private schools. Where do their kids go? Private schools. We want you to give up your Second Amendment rights, but we ain't giving up our Second Amendment rights. I got guards with guns all over me because my life's more important than your life, and my kids are more important than your kids. So they're against charter schools, many of the liberal politicians, but all their kids go to charter schools. They don't go to the public school. So it's just hypocrisy, and yet most people are too stupid to even see the hypocrisy. They're like, Don Quixote? Who was the guy that followed Don Quixote? Sanchez? I think that's his name. Yeah, Don Quixote had a servant that followed around, Sanchez, I think it was his name. And the only person that's more stupid than Don Quixote is Sanchez. Because Don Quixote is chasing windmills, crusader, human good. And this idiot's following them around. So that's what most people do with these politicians, and they should be able to spot them. Because if you're going to tell me something, and I can see that you're not doing it, your words are about as empty as the wind. And there you go. So, and again, it's very curious that we're in a political season that all the folks on the left that are advocating the spread around, and, you know, I'm going to take wealth and move it here and there, they're all multimillionaires. And they're not spreading their money around. Oh, no. If they do, they're spreading it to secret bank accounts so nobody can find it with lots of money. It's just, it's bizarre, very bizarre. And yet we have a lot of, was it Sanchez? It was, anyway, we'll have to look up his name. He was a servant that followed Don Quixote around. And that's these people. They just follow these people around. I'd give Don Quixote about 2 seconds before I said, hey, dude, catch you later. I got to go out and do some stuff in the real world. And so we have, so he says, I'm applying myself to work in Wall, my servants, and everybody else, 17. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was 1 ox and 6 choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me, and once in 10 days all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on this people. He didn't increase taxes on the people to enrich himself and the nobles and the people that he had, the uppity-up people. They ate an ox, they ate a couple of sheep, but they weren't, they had abundance, they had enough to live on, but he didn't squash people. It was a Sancho? Sancho. Yeah, just hit me. It wasn't Sanchez, it was Sancho. So he's not hitting these people up. He's not a crooked capitalist. And as we've said many times, that capitalism demands virtue in the people to work. Virtue means doing the right thing in the right way. Capitalists that are crooked, they don't care about other people. They're arrogant. They have criminal mentalities. They just care about themselves. They're insensitive to others and hypersensitive about themselves, and they engage in capitalism, and they're crooks. So when people see crooks that are capitalists, they automatically assume, stupidly, that socialism is the way to go. They don't realize that socialism is inherently evil. There's never a time when socialism is good. And, of course, the only time capitalism is good is when the capitalist has virtue. Or at least they have 85% virtue, because nobody's got 100% virtue. And so he's a good capitalist. 19, remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. He's a good leader. The same prayer that Solomon prayed when he was a young man. He said, I want to be a good leader. He was a great leader. His personal life was a mess, but he was a great leader. God answered that prayer because he understood the divine institutions. He didn't follow them himself all the time, but he understood them and he promoted them. He didn't downgrade them. We have people in this country that despise the divine institutions, which are, of course, individualism, privacy is number one. Number two is marriage between a man and a woman. Number three is the family, where you raise kids and teach them, not schools. And number four, of course, is nationalism, which includes the subcomponents of capitalism, strong military, law and order on the bench, police officers on the street, and respect for authority. Those are the things that make a nation great. And Nehemiah knows these things. He does these things. And to boot, he's a believer. He's a mature believer. Chapter 6. Now, when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem, the Arab, and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors in the gates. Now, you've got to put the gates in. Of course, the doors are big, gigantic wooden doors. And these are timbers, huge timbers from Lebanon, which are special timbers. And so they hadn't quite got those set up. So there is one place you can still attack, which is the gates. You can still come through some of these gates that aren't fully set. And to set those big doors up on the hinges takes 2 men and a boy, as we say. I mean, that's not easy work to get those things set properly. You got to have the right dimensions. You got to have the right boards and the whole 9 yards. So verse 2, then Sanballat, and Geshem sent a message to me saying, come, let us meet together at Sephirim in the plain of Ono. But they were planning to harm me. And of course, it's typical. People say one thing, they want to do another. They want to have them come out with a flag of truce to talk. Well, what have you got to talk about with people that hate you? Really nothing. And that's the diplomacy, of course, is speak softly, carry a big stick. All you got to say to do with these people is a big stick. You have nothing to say to these people. Verse 3. So I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? So these people understand, if I can get Nehemiah out of the city, then we can do some work on these people with propaganda, because he is the George Washington. And that's smart. I mean, you want to kill the key person. You want to wipe out the key person, and then the whole thing will unravel. So they're not any dummies, but he's not stupid either. He realizes that he is a key component that's putting spine in these people. And he's very charismatic. Love to meet Nehemiah. He's very charismatic, very strong, very intelligent. He's a very wise person. He's very positive to doctrine. He's smart. He doesn't jump the gun. And he's taken, you know, things that he has to do. He's taken direct and personal responsibility for stuff. Verse 4, they sent messages to me 4 times in this matter, and I answered them in the same way. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a 5th time with an open letter in his hand. Open letter means they're going to read it to all the people. And in it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Gashmu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king, according to these reports. So the open letter, of course, goes to everybody. He wants the Persians to find out about this open letter, so they'll go back and report it to the king. And the king, of course, has his own contingent in the area. Not a large little army, but it's a small little force, which is probably another reason that these guys didn't attack, because there's some Persian military in the place. And the Persian military are going to fight on the side of the Jews. And if you kill the Persian military, then it's going to be bad news for you, because then the big Persian army will come out from Susa and rub you out. So this is a better way to do it. Verse 7, you have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah, and now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together. So in other words, they're trying to intimidate Nehemiah. We got an open letter here. And if you want us to recant the open letter or write another letter saying, well, these things aren't really true, then come meet us. And of course, as soon as he comes meets these people, they're going to cut his throat. But they're trying every way they possibly can. And of course, they know that there's certain Persian officials that are going to come to the same conclusion. Because most of the autonomous areas under the Persian Empire, they don't have walls around their city. Because the first thing you do when you're going to revolt, if you're an autonomous people under the empire, is you got to prepare. You got to have a military. You got to have a wall around your city so you can fight it out. And of course, if you're stirring up trouble, that's what you want to do. And so this is what these people are trying to imply. Verse 8, then I sent a message to him saying, such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind. Yes, that's exactly right. They're inventing them in their own mind. Sins of the tongue and mental attitude, son, sins. 9, for all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. So they were thinking that the people would automatically say, you know, they're right. And the Persians might come in here and wipe us all out. We know what happened when the Chaldeans came and wiped us all out. Not that many generations ago. Therefore, let's not hang these gates, but let's tear down the walls that we've already put up. Let's just get the sledgehammers out and tear everything down from the inside. Verse 10. When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Methatabel, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night. So they know that he's not going to come out, so they're going to send in assassins to come in and slit his throat in the dark. They're going to find Nehemiah and they're going to kill him. So some of the other people know about this and they say, look, let's get you into the most secure place in the city, which is within the temple. You got temple guards. Certainly the Levites are temple guards and they're armed. They have shields, they have swords, they have spears, and they're going to protect him. Verse 11, but I said, should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. He's not yellow. He's not a yellow belly. I remember when I was in Haiti, we deployed down there in 1995, and you had Aristide, I think was his name was. He was the new leader of Haiti. He's kind of a weaselly little fellow. And I remember he would not go out in public without a gigantic shield around him, a big plexiglass shield around his car or whatever it was. And he'd go out to the crowds, and he was a man of the people, but he didn't want the people to shoot him. So he always had these little bubbles around him. I think the Pope also has a Pope Mobile, which has now a shield around it, so you can't shoot him. If you're going to be a man of the people, you've got to get out amongst the people, because you really can't say I'm a man of the people and I fear nothing if you've got lots of bodyguards and shields around you all the time. Our current president, of course, sets himself up for assassination all the time. He is out with all sorts of crowds. I mean, one crowd after the other, after the other, after the other, and they can't screen them all, because almost at every rally, some idiot's up there yelling some type of thing about global warming's killing us all. Well, if that person got in with that, they could get in with a weapon and take a shot at him. But he's out there amongst the people all the time. I hope he's got a vest on under his clothes, because I anticipate someone's going to try to kill him. There are too many people and too much hate. But that's what you got to do. If you're going to be a leader, you got to be a leader. You can't be a weasel. People will not respond to a weasel as a leader. You've got to be out there amongst the troops, amongst the people. So he says, I'm not going to do it. I will not run. If it's my time to die, then I will die like a man. If it's not my time to die, they can't kill me. Now, he wasn't, going out there he would take the normal precautions. I'm sure he had a couple of bodyguards, but he wasn't going to run. So all leaders have a couple of bodyguards and a couple of bruisers standing around them, which you should. If I was a public speaker, I know exactly who I'd have for one of my bodyguards. Somebody sitting in this congregation. And, we're out normal precautions, but I'm not going to run. You're just not the type of leader. And he's not the type of leader at all. At least I'd like to think I wouldn't run, but you never know what you're going to do until it happens. But I had past experience to guide myself, and I've had chances where I could run. I didn't run. Got beat up instead. But that's okay. But at least you didn't run. So he said, I'm not going to go. Should a man like me flee? And the answer, of course, is no. Hell no. Verse 12. Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. So this guy, of course, was a hired person. So some of these folks were sincere, I'm sure, saying, hey, we got to take extra precaution for you. But some of them, of course, simply wanted him to go inside the temple so people would see that he's yellow. Or they'd kill him himself inside the temple. It's not unknown that prophets were killed on the very steps of the temple. Happened all the time. So either way, you're going to lose, because people, smart people, can see if you're our leader, you got to be out in front. That's what leaders do. They're in the front. They're not in the back. That's one of the reasons during the war between the states, the Southern Officer Corps was decimated in the first 2-3 years of the war, because their leaders were always out in the front leading, which they won victories, but at a terrible cost, where Yankee leaders would usually be in the back and say, go get them, boys. That's why their casualties weren't as high. But they had a lot of Yankees. I mean, they were outnumbered and outnumbered the Confederates all the time. That was one of the problems in the Army of Northern Virginia. Lee was looking around in 1864, and all his good commanders are dead, from the company grade, field grade, all dead. And you're getting people that don't have that quality because they led from the front. Like Stonewall Jackson was way too far out in the front. He took steps that were beyond common sense. He was outside his own lines, reconnoitering for the next day's attack. And then when he's coming back to his lines, he was mistaken as a Yankee entourage, and they shot him. North Carolina troops, not their fault. This guy's outside of his own lines, scouting. He's a three-star general. Three-star generals don't go outside your own lines to scout. You put your scouts out there to scout. It was just very ill-advised. But he was brave, and that's how he won many victories. He was always out front. And so that's what the plot was. So these guys are smart. The enemy's smart. They're trying everything. Psychological warfare, they're all about it. And, of course, Nehemiah has his own spies out there. So he says he perceived these things. Well, how did he perceive them? We're not told. But he's a smart dude. And smart people also have their own informants. And they, probably some of his own informants said, hey, you know, here's the real skinny on this dude. Verse 13, he was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. It would be a sin. God doesn't want you to hide. God doesn't need you to hide. You know, do not fear, because he's telling the people, do not fear. Well, if you're telling the people, do not fear, and you fear and run, that's not going to work. It would be a sin. That's not your place of duty. Your place of duty is at the front, and that's where you're supposed to be, in your place of duty. Whatever you do, you stay in your place of duty. Verse 14, remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these words, works of theirs, and also Nodiah, the prophetess, and the rest of the prophets who are trying to frighten me. So these are evil prophets and evil prophetesses. So we're told that females also had the gift of prophecy in the Old Testament dispensation. There's a couple of females that had that gift. In the New Testament, we don't have any prophets anymore, male or female, at all. That's gone, long gone, because we have the Word of God now. And they were trying to frighten him. We saw this also in the book of Jeremiah, false prophets everywhere, false prophets. God told me this. God didn't tell you that. Verse 15, so the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. That would be October. And 52 days after he came there, when they started building the wall, rather, in the month of October, they completed the wall. 52 days. That's an amazing feat. How'd they do it? Well, they worked. They kept their clothes on night and day as much as they possibly could in shifts. And, of course, they had the materials already pre-positioned. They had some very smart people working on this stuff, and they had a great leader. 16, when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Also in those days, many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Moreover, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So these people have alliances, of course, is what he's telling you, that they're intertwined with these peoples that are around about them. And Tobiah, of course, is still trying to do all he can to hinder God's works and to hinder Nehemiah and whatever Nehemiah is going to do. Because Nehemiah, of course, is the governor. We're told that he's been appointed the governor. He got some letters that appointed him as the governor of this of Judah as well. And he was a very good governor. Chapter 7, Census of First Returned Exiles. Now when the wall was rebuilt, and I had set up the doors, and the gatekeepers, and the singers, and the Levites were appointed. Remember, he's going to reinstitute the Mosaic Law. It has never been fully reinstituted from the time that the Chaldeans came in and rubbed the southern kingdom out. And you've got to have the Levites. You've got to have the singers. Remember, all the book of Psalm, was sung. They had a professional choir that would sing this as part of how they learned Bible doctrine for those that could not read. Then I had put Hanai, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Again, why is this person put in that position? Same thing as Paul. Faithful. Faithful, faithful is always the key. Why are you where you are? Because you're faithful. All you got to do is be faithful to the word. And there are no excuses. There are no legitimate excuses. There are no illegitimate excuses. There are no excuses for anybody that's a believer not reaching maturity. There is no such thing as a good excuse because there are no excuses. He feared God more than many. So he's not the most mature believer in the nation, but he is a mature believer in the nation. And he's good at his job. He's a good killer. He's a good commander, and he's faithful. Verse 3, and that's the quality you really want to have in a friend or anything is faithfulness, through thick or thin. Verse 3, then I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they are standing guard, let them shut and bolt the doors. Also appoint guards from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, each at his post and each in front of his own house. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not built. So obviously, why don't open the gate till it's hot? Because again, in the pre-dawn area, if you open the gates up too soon, the enemy could have snuck up, and then they could rush the place and get inside the gate before you can get a guard to close the gate. So you want to have a limited time when that gate's open and make it very clear that you can see what's going on. And we're told here that the city's built, but there's not a lot of people in the city. Why? Because you can't really grow things in the city. It's a place where you do commerce and you have tradesmen and all these other things, but most of the people, including the Levites, for many, many years, they're living out in the fields, in the suburbs, in the surrounding areas, and they're farmers. They're agricultural people. And so you don't have a whole lot of people there. And of course, how do you sustain people in the city? Taxes and commerce. And the more people we have in there, then people can start bringing their foods in to buy and sell their vegetables in within the city. Verse 5, then my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled by genealogies. Then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first, in which I found the following record. So he's found books. And Jews were always big on keeping the books. Along with the Torah, which are the first five books of the Bible, they had the other books. They had the book of Daniel. They had the book of Isaiah. They had all sorts of books that they kept. These are the sacred scrolls that they kept, and they were holy. And even in the toughest times, when the Chaldeans were slamming on the door, they buried a lot of copies of these things. They took a lot of copies with them. So Ezekiel, they have all the books that are out there that are available. They're going to discover some other books, and he's going to reinstitute the study of the Mosaic Law from the Torah. So we have in verse 6, these are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away and who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. So remember, the people returned when Cyrus the Great issued that first decree in 536 B.C. The place went down in 586. They were exiled. And then, of course, when the Persians took over from the Chaldean Empire, Cyrus the Great immediately allowed a big chunk to go back. About 50,000 plus went back. And of course, they were very keen on who's going back, and they kept a very detailed genealogy of all these people. Verse 7, and remember, most of these people are from the tribe of Judah, who came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ra'amiah, Nahamani, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispereth, Bigvai, Nehum, Bana, the number of men of the people of Israel. And you can read these things for you. We're not going to go through these. We're going to skip through the verses here, but it starts out with the sons of Parash, 2,172. And the list goes on and on and on to include Solomon's servants in verse 60. And different people that came from different tribes. This is the chronology of all these people. We don't know who these people are. We know, however, that they're a very detailed list is kept of these people, which shows, of course, they want to know exactly who everybody is, and they keep very strict records. And that's why, of course, Jesus, when he came in time, he could point back to these records and trace his lineage right back to King David. And he had no problem doing that, because a lot of these records had been recaptured and recopied and reinstituted and put back in the library. verse 66, the whole assembly together was 42,360 people, besides their male and their female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 245 male and female singers. And then they talk about the horses of 736, their mules, 245, their camels, 435, their donkeys, 6,720. So we see that the entourage had a lot of stuff when they went back. They just didn't go back as very poor people. They had a lot of stuff with them. And then verse 71 talks about the heads of the father's household gave into the treasury of the work 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,200 silver minas. The rest of the people gave was verse 72. That which the rest of the people gave was 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,000 silver minas and 67 priests' garments, because the priests have to have the garments. The Levites have to have their things. You've got to have the animal sacrifices. You've got a lot of things that go into making the temple operation run. And so that's what we have here, is the description of how that all occurred. Now, these numbers don't exactly line up with other numbers in other parts of the scripture because they're emphasizing different things. That's all they're emphasizing, is different things in terms of who all these people were. And if you count some of the group together as the servants, or if you don't count them, you come up with a little slightly different number. But basically, the number was around 50,000. Here we got 42,360, besides their male and female servants. And they add on more figures onto that. So it just depends on what you want to emphasize. Chapter 8. And all the people gathered as one man at the square, which was in front of the water gate. And they asked Ezra, the scribe, to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel. This we call the Torah. It's the first five books of the Bible, starting with Genesis. Then Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men, women, and all who could listen with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. He read from it before the square, which was in front of the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of men and women, those who could understand, and all the people were attentive to the book of the law. Ezra the scribe stood at a wooden podium, which they had made for the purpose. And beside him stood, and we have a whole bunch of people that are named there. And then verse 5, Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was standing above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. Then Ezra blessed the Lord, the great God, and all the people answered, Amen, Amen, which means I believe, I believe, while lifting up their hands. When they bowed low and worshiped, then they bowed low and worshiped the Lord with their faces to the ground. Also, Jeshua, Bani, and we have a whole list of people here, explained the law to the people while the people remained in their place. So we have a list of, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 people. You've got a lot of people here. So they divide up these teachers, if you will, to go out to the people into groups and tell them what these things mean in English. Here's what it all means. And that's what their job was to do. Verse 8, they read from the book, from the law of God, translating to give the sense so that they understood the reading. You've got to communicate in a way that people understand. Some of these churches around here in the old days, they used to speak in Latin, and people don't understand Latin. But it sounded good, and they knew nothing. But they went away, and they had done their duty by going to church. And yet the entire thing's carried out in Latin, and nobody knows what it means. So it's very important to communicate in a way that people can understand what you are saying, and that's the point here. We also have the issue of somebody has to teach them. These people aren't going to get it by sitting there and whistling Dixie and contemplating their navel and turnips. Someone has to teach you, and they have to be receptive. So that's our 8 R's again. Reception, right? And they rebound, of course. And then they learn by repetition. They heard it once from Ezra the scribe. Now they're going to hear it broken down. You're going to hear it again. And who knows how many times they repeated these things. And they're very glad to repeat these things until they understand it. Because without understanding, it's just words that bounce up and bounce down. They might sound good, but they don't mean anything. The purpose of communication is to make information known. Verse 9, then Nehemiah, who was a governor, and Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, this day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep. For all the people were weeping when they heard the words of the law. Emotion. Emotion's not bad. There's good emotion and bad emotion. This is good emotion. They are realizing at last we're going to reinstitute these things. We are going to be God's people once more. And we all know what happened when our ancestors turned against the Lord God. We are not going to do that. We are going to make up our minds to follow what we're supposed to do. And in their dispensation, that was to follow the Mosaic Law. Verse 10. Now, the Mosaic Law doesn't save you. It teaches you things. But that's how they learned. Verse 10. Then he said to them, "Go eat of the fat, drink of the sweet, and send portions to him who has nothing prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." So they're sharing things. And if you have family members, you share stuff with family members. Not everybody does the cooking. Some people don't even bring stuff to a family picnic. They just show up and eat. Do you deny them to eat because they didn't bring chicken or beans? No, you let them eat. So on this special occasion, because they're all Jews, you got to eat even if you didn't bring anything. This is not the rule. This is the exception to the rule. The rule is get a job. But there's an exception to the rule. Your relatives ain't going to come over every day to eat. Now, if I've got a holiday, yeah, you can come over and eat, and I'll spring the bill. But don't be showing up every day, you know, with your paper plate trying to get filled up. But that ain't going to happen, Captain. You know, you've got to get a job like the rest of us. But on this special occasion, it's an indication that we're all brothers. We're all sharing things together. And sometimes that's very appropriate. Other times, it's not appropriate. Verse 11, so the Levites calmed all the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." All the people went away to eat, to drink, to send portions, and to celebrate a great festival, because they understood the words which had been made known to them. They were happy to understand. And boy, I know that feeling, because I read the entire Bible when I was a youngster. I didn't understand a word of it, because somebody told me, if you read the Bible, you'll be blessed. Okay, I'll read it. I was at, 18, 19. I read it all. Didn't understand a thing. But I read it all. And then later, when I started to learn Bible doctrine, I was much happier, because I could actually understand what it meant. And that's why they're happy, because somebody explained to them what this stuff means. They told them what the rituals mean. When we cut the lamb's throat, folks, here's what it means. When the priest puts his head, Leviticus chapter 2, on the animal's head, he's transferring the sins of the people onto this lamb. Now, it doesn't really happen, but it's an analogy of what's going to happen. Oh, thank you. Ritual without reality is meaningless. And the reality, of course, is the teaching, what it means. So they're very happy to know those things. And that's what we try to do in this Bible class, so you know something. Verse 13, and we'll stop at this chapter, but we've got a few more verses to go. Then on the second day, the heads of fathers' households of all the people, the priests and the Levites, were gathered to Ezra the scribe, that they might gain insight into the words of the law. They want more information. Now, the heads of the household, remember, divine institution number 3, the family. The man, the husband, is the head of the household. Now, the husband can delegate things to the wife, and in terms of disciplining children, both of them have equal responsibility, but the husband is still the head of the household. That's why the head of the household is gathered together, because it's their responsibility to do these things, and they want more insight into the word. What a wonderful experience this would be to be back in that time with these people, because you've got a whole lot of people that are positive Bible doctrine. That's rare. It happens from time to time in the course of human history. You get a glob of people that are positive. But generally, that ain't happening. It's very, very, very rare for people to be positive to doctrine. I mean, extremely rare. Here you've got one of those rare occasions in human history where you got a whole bunch of people that, at least for now, they're very positive. How many remain positive? Another question. I doubt if they all remain positive, because it's one thing to have a full head of steam, but who lasts the entire race? As Paul said, we all run the race, but only one person is going to win. And the one person that wins is the believer that's positive to doctrine. All believers are in the race, but only a handful actually reach the winner's circle at the very end of the race. Verse 14, they found written in the law how the Lord had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the seventh month. Now, this feast, and this is in your book also, teaches about the millennium. It's called the Feast of the Booths, which means God is going to take care of you. So this feast was a teaching tool. It's to call the Boost, or the Feast of the Tabernacle. What does that mean? Well, you live in a house. Most people don't like to live in tents. They like to live in a house. If you have to live in a tent, you got to live in a tent. But during this particular feast, everyone was expected to get the heck out of the house and put your tent in the backyard. So if you just imagine, if you're back in that dispensation, you live in a house. During this feast, you'd have to put a tent in the backyard and live in the tent. Well, what does that mean? Well, it stands for something, obviously. It stands for the fact that God is going to provide for you a tent there in the millennium, the Jewish people. I'm going to take care of you all. I will do it. So get out of your house and let me do it. It's a teaching tool. Now, if you didn't know that, you say, what the hell I got to go out in a tent for? You know, it's cold out there. It's not the Holiday Inn. And, you know, so if you don't know what it stands for, you might do the ritual. Does it do you any good? No, you just grumble. Well, I'm doing it because they said to do it. But why are you doing it? In each of these holy festivals represents something. All of them do. The Feast of the Atonement, represents the death of Christ. The Passover, the death of Christ, rather. And then you have different feasts that represent different parts of the plan of God. So we got verse 16. So the people went out and brought them and made booths for themselves, each on his roof, and in their courts, and in the courts of the house of God, in the square of the water gate, in the square of the gate of Ephraim. The entire assembly of those who returned from the captivity made booths and lived in them. The sons of Israel had indeed not done so from the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, to that day. And there was great rejoicing. They hadn't done this ritual for a long time. They had not done the Feast of the Booths. And again, more importantly, somebody explained to them what it meant. And what it meant was there's going to come a time when you Jews, and we're not just rule this little area, you're going to rule all the way from the Euphrates to the Nile. And that's a lot of territory. And this is the millennium. You will rule the world. You'll have a gigantic nation and you will rule the world during the millennium. That's what that feast meant. And do you think that's a happy feast? Yeah, it's a happy feast. Because it told them what's coming. And they rejoiced greatly. 18, he read from the book of the law of God daily, from the first day to the last day. And they celebrated the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, there was a solemn assembly according to the ordinance. This feast lasted 7 days. And during that 7 days, they studied Bible doctrine, Bible doctrine, Bible doctrine, and they were happy. It was a system of great joy to them. With their head bowed and eyes closed, Father, thank you for the privilege of studying your holy word. We thank you for these words of wisdom. We know that ritual without reality is meaningless. We thank you that you have given us the reality of the mystery doctrine in our dispensation of the church age. So we know your full plan. We know that your plan for us is to reach maturity in the intensified stage of the angelic conflict. We do that by learning and applying Bible doctrine, our daily portion. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.